session today is that I'm going to be covering off is on lightning fast web performance with via front-end optimization. Some of you may know me, some of you may not know me. I'm Matt Vorman. I've been in the web and rich media development industry for over 15 years. I currently work with Akamai. Akamai is probably a company that some of you have heard of. Most of you probably haven't heard of Akamai. Yet probably I'd say everyone in this room would use Akamai services on a daily basis. Akamai is a cloud-based managed services provider. One of the services that we provide is as a content distribution network, or a CDN. So we have customers such as Apple, Microsoft, Adobe, Facebook, Google. They all leverage our infrastructure and our network on a day-to-day basis. So we basically are an underlying infrastructure that I guess spreads the world. We have 84,000 servers distributed around the world, and we'll talk a little bit about CDNs and the benefits CDNs can actually bring to the fray a bit further on in the presentation. Prior to my life with Akamai, I was working with Adobe. I worked with Adobe both here in Australia and also in the US, where I was a senior technical consultant. I specialised primarily on rich internet applications or flash-based applications. I have a bit of a history with the Flash platform. I've written or contributed to a number of books and white papers on the platform. And just, I guess, prior to my life with Adobe, I also was one of the co-founders of Rocket Boots with Robin and Andrew Muller. So if you're interested to drop me a line after the session, or if you want to reach out and contact me, or just follow me on Twitter, you can get my details there or come and have a chat to me afterwards. So let's talk about the problem of the internet today and what users are actually faced with on a day-to-day basis. I guess as the internet's progressed or developed over time, users are just becoming impatient. Obviously, download speeds have increased, performance of processing speed has increased, and this obviously is a long way away from where things started back in the early days of the internet, back in the early 90s. Back in the early 90s, when web pages were first being developed, they actually were pretty small, obviously, because the available bandwidth was not anything near what we have today. And the average web page back in the 90s or the early 90s was about 9K. And fast forward to today, and it's about 35 times, roughly, the average size of a web page back in the 90s. Page load times, about 5 seconds. That's probably not too far from the speeds that we were getting back in the day. Obviously, we've got bigger pipes now, but we've got a lot more content that's being pushed down through those pipes. So you can see that an average page there contains up to 44 different objects that are being served from 7 different domains, which is a lot of info just to cram and to pull down in any one particular point in time. If we go back in time, you'd only be looking, say, like 3 objects, possibly, and maybe just from a single domain. And a Google, a Google Web Metrics survey or research that they actually did just recently was they found that 80 to 90% of response time involved in actually rendering pages and actually presenting content to end users actually occurs in the front end. And so predominantly this is in the browser or in the transmission of the data across to the browser. This, of course, has some significant impacts on business. We're talking about poor performance here and how poor performance impacts business. Every second counts. And when we look at the impact that every second can have on end user experience and also on reduced conversions, Gartner and Forrester have done some really interesting surveys, or done some research rather, into the actual cost associated with poor performing websites and poor performing end user web experiences. And we see figures of $1.3 billion of lost revenue every year due to poor end user experience and poor websites incorrectly designed. And so basically, reduced conversion rate, obviously this ultimately is going to end up in poor revenue at the end of the day. A one second delay in download times for an end user can result in a 7% drop-off rate of end users. So every second literally does count in terms of abandonment of end users and abandonment of users interacting with your websites. So how do we fix this? There's not really any magic bullet. There's no magic secret sauce that's associated with this. It really is just sort of common sense. And my apologies if I'm going to be preaching to the converted here, because a lot of what I'm going to tell you guys here today really is actually quite common sense. And it's just a number of reasons why these best practices aren't currently being used in web development. So, you know, just follow the basics, Web Dev 101. It really, really is, as I said, there's nothing simple, there's nothing overtly secret about what I'm going to be telling you here today. They're just basic foundation web development technologies and skill sets that you guys should be looking at leveraging. Yahoo and Google acknowledge this, and they actually both put out guidelines, a set of guidelines and also a set of rules, which together they actually make up probably about 65, 70 different individual rules which can help improve the performance of your website. Yahoo have YSLOW. I'm not sure if you've heard of YSLOW. Google have PageSpeed. I'm sure that all of you may or may not have heard of either of these guidelines or these best practices. They both also have plugins as well. So if you want to be able to check the optimization and the performance of your websites, you can use these plugins and just basically see how well your sites are actually performing. You can also use third parties. So if you decide that it's all just too much hard work, there are a number of third parties out there actually making quite a good living from actually essentially all that they're doing are implementing these best practices and these rules. Aptamize is a really good example. They're a company that was actually founded out of New Zealand. They're now based in Silicon Valley, and they basically have a hardware performance kit that essentially just applies all of the guidelines and the rules that we're going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about all of them. I'm not going to go through 65 different rules or guidelines, but what I am going to do is cover off on, I guess, the key elements and the key points that both Google and Yahoo have actually recommended to improve the performance of your websites. So if we break it down, the guidelines that these guys have recommended come in fundamentally four different flavors. We've got caching, we've got round trip times, we've got requests, and also the payload associated with the content that you're going to be passing over the network. So let's just have a look at caching and how we can actually go about optimizing our caching. So the first point that I've got there is obviously to be able to leverage browser caching wherever you can. It makes sense that if we want to as quick a render time as possible, if we want to access our assets as quickly as possible, the closer we can have those assets to the end user, this is going to obviously expedite things along. So essentially, if you're able to load assets from a local cache as opposed to a remote or an origin cache, it's certainly going to speed things up in this regards. And the way in which we go about ensuring that our assets are actually cached locally is to set the expiry or the cache control headers when we actually configure our web servers. Essentially, what this allows us to do, it allows us to set the freshness of content that we're actually going to be delivering to end users. So we can specify how long we want that content to exist on the end user's cache before it needs to go back and check whether that content has been updated or whether it's been refreshed. When you're setting your cache control headers or your expiry values, it pays to be a bit more aggressive with the dates or the times that you're actually going to be applying to them. Fundamentally, if you can set it to, say, for example, at least a month up to a year, ideally, that's a good sort of window. It depends, obviously, on how frequently your content's going to be changing, but you know, I think that there are actually some guidelines that stipulate that you shouldn't actually set the expiry or the cache control headers to be over a year. And also apply this to all cacheable content. A lot of people just think, oh, I should just only apply it to images. But the reality is that everything, you know, things such as JavaScript and CSS, static content like PDFs, they're all cacheable, Flash content, Swifts. So you can actually apply these rules to all content, all static content. Leverage proxy caching where possible. So proxy caching is essentially public caching. Every ISP, or most good ISPs, will have a proxy cache located within their data center. Essentially, what that does is it allows them to cache hot content. sites like Google, that you know you have high search results, news sites, content that's frequently viewed will often be cached in these proxy caches, which will be located in ISPs. So if you can't serve the content from a local cache, think about going to a proxy cache. A couple of gotchas or things to watch out for with the proxy caches is that most proxy caches don't actually like query strings. So don't use any question marks or query strings in your URLs if you're actually going to be serving content. And also, the other thing to keep in mind is that proxy caches are public. So don't keep any cookies on any proxy caches that you're going to be using. In order to just to leverage, I guess, proxy caching, all you need to do is set the cache control header to public, and it'll automatically be cached at the ISP or at public caches based on that cache control header. Make AJAX cacheable. Lots of people think that because AJAX is dynamic, and you know, yes, it is dynamic, and yes, the requests are created on the fly, and content can be extremely individual based on individual requests that are passed down the wire. But the reality is that it's just broken down into JavaScript and XML. So while some of those, some of that script or some of that content can't be cached because it changes on an extremely regular basis, there's a lot of that content, a lot of AJAX content that can actually be cached. So if we take, for example, an address book in an AJAX application, the address book may or may not change on a regular basis. Now, what you can do if you actually, when you're actually writing or setting up the writing of the address book, if you specify a last updated date, you can actually use the last updated date to check to see whether the whether the address book has actually been updated. If it has been updated, then obviously go grab a new version. But if it hasn't been updated, then serve the old one from cache. Gzip and compression. So we'll talk a bit more about that a bit later on down the line, but you know, JavaScript and XML can be compressed, and some people know this, a lot of people don't leverage it, so it's important to keep that into mind. Minify your JavaScript, and also for those of you that don't know what minification is just simply stripping out the white space, line breaks, any extraneous characters that are contained within JavaScript or CSS, and essentially it makes it a lot faster in the upload and the download over the wire. And if you're going to be using GET requests, it's preferable to use GET requests rather than POST requests, because there's actually two packets which are actually sent in a POST request as opposed to only one packet that's sent over the wire with a GET request. So once again, we're talking about optimizing performance here, and this is definitely, every little bit helps in this regards. And then the last point that I got here in regards to caching is in regards to making landing pages, landing page redirects cacheable. Now, I'll talk a bit further on about how redirects are not a good practice. We try to avoid them if possible. But in mobile sites, this is kind of the exception to the rule. Got an example there of example.com, which has a redirect to m.example.com. So typically, if a user is going to be browsing to your site on a mobile device, this is where you want to be able to set up a cached redirect page on that device so that the user is able to automatically or instantly redirect to the actual mobile site that they're going to be viewing. So this speeds up load times for repeat users. If you're going to be using a redirect, try using a 300. A 302 is typically what's used for redirect requests. And also include vary headers, vary a user agent, and also the cache control headers. It's worth keeping in mind that we want to set the cache control header to private, because this helps specify the user is only going to be redirected to the mobile site, and only mobile users will be redirected, as opposed to just standard web users. So that was caching. Let's have a look at round trip times and see what we can do to actually cut down some of the round trip times. So first of all, let's look at DNS lookups. So one of the things that it takes a lot of time, if you recall back in the original slide, I was talking about how a typical website, a web page at any given time, can actually have up to 7 different domains that are being referenced. Now this can be third-party content that's actually being called. So each of these DNS lookups that are occurring in the background, they all take time and they're all impacting on performance. So essentially what we want to do is minimize the amount of DNS lookups that can occur. This is not always possible, but there's some tricks and some things that we can actually do to help or facilitate better DNS lookups. First of them being is increasing your TTLs, your time to live on your actual DNS config. So essentially, the DNS config files are cacheable, and TTL is basically a time to live. It specifies how long that file can live for before it needs to go and check whether it's been updated. Now, typically, if you can set a long TTL value or a high TTL value, this is going to stop the request having to go ferreting around looking higher up the chain looking for to resolve this request, because the config is actually going to be current. So obviously, if you can increase the TTLs on your DNS configs, this is going to assist. I talked about reducing the number of DNS lookups. They say that 1 to 5 is an ideal number. It's when you start to get above 5 that things start to actually get lagged down. So keep that in mind. It's also worth keeping in mind that you want to use URL paths instead of host names. Because if we've got, in the example that I've got up there, we've got www.example.com/dev. If I was to set that to, say, a subdomain or a new host name to dev.example.com, it's a separate DNS lookup, despite it but still being for the same URL or for the same site that the user is going to be hitting. So once again, what we're trying to do here is reduce the number of DNS lookups that are actually going to be occurring in any instance that the user is going to be on our site. Excuse me, mate. Let me grab the screens, just dropped off. Gotta love gaffer tape. Thanks, mate. So, moving on from round trip times, we also want to look at minimizing redirects where possible. Redirects are a common occurrence. They're something that that we will encounter just about on a very regular basis. But in some instances, you'll know that sites certainly will always redirect you. There'll be references to code that'll be redirecting you in the background. Where possible, if you can find out where that code is being redirected to, if you can actually use that URL rather than forcing the trip to actually bypass and be detoured, this is going to cut down round trip times. Try to reduce any redirects that you have. The number of hops that you're going to be experiencing, we want to reduce that obviously down. One is ideal, so you want to try and keep that as low as possible. And if you do have to use redirects, try and use a server redirect rather than use an HTTP redirect rather than a JavaScript or a metadata-based redirect. Reason being is that HTTP redirects 300s are set on the server. JavaScript and metadata ones are set on the client. And the browser is actually able to handle 300s a lot easier. The performance and the ability to work with a 300, or a response, I should say, is a lot faster than having to actually parse a page or a script and then realize that it has to be redirected. So if you can, if you have to redirect, then try and use a server-based redirect to 300. Otherwise, then I guess you're stuck with a JavaScript or a metadata one. Bad requests, it's a fact of life. Everybody's going to encounter them from time to time. There could be a number of causes that bring these upon us, a bane of our lives. A lot of the time it's just slackness. Users will move directories or move content around without adhering to standards, and so it's as I said, it's inevitable, but it is a wasted request. From a professionalism point of view, it's unprofessional, and also it's a bad user experience if there's nothing there. Don't just stick a redirect in front of a 400 if you encounter it. Just actually, if your content has permanently moved, then actually reconfigure your code or update your code to actually redirect to the user to the updated code. Don't just redirect them. And Google has some webmaster tools. There's actually a crawl error tool that you can use to actually crawl each of the the redirects or the links that are actually in your code, so you can actually see whether or not you're actually going to be redirecting someone off to a 404. Combining external scripts, once again, we want to reduce the number of requests that are actually being made. So what if we can do, if you have a number of external JavaScript files and a number of external CSS files, you want to try and bundle those together in a single script page or a single script file where possible. Now, there's a couple of caveats to this rule. The ideal number for script is either one or two for external script files. The reason being is that what we want to do is there's going to be, let's say, for example, JavaScript code that's specific to perhaps the rendering of a web page. There also might be script JavaScript that's associated with some sort of functions or some sort of user interaction. Now, ideally, what we want to do is we want to execute the page rendering code first before the user is actually able to interact with the code. So it makes sense that we actually basically chunk out or group out the interactivity-related JavaScript code into a single JavaScript file and then only use the initial JavaScript file that's going to be loaded that actually references the rendering or content that's going to be rendered on screen. And the same applies also for CSSs. There's no reason why you can't actually group them all together into as low a number as possible. At the end of the day, we're just reducing the number of requests that are going to need to be made around the wire. We want to look at optimizing our scripts and our style orders. So on the screen there, I'm not sure how well you can see that, but essentially what we've got on screen there is we've got a set of JavaScript and CSS files that are being pulled into a web page. And you can see that we've got a 300 millisecond delay, I guess, is the time that it's taking to actually download this content. Now, the way in which browsers actually parse and render JavaScript and CSS code is that when it actually encounters JavaScript files, it basically stops what it's doing and has to parse the JavaScript file before it can actually continue on to do anything else. So this is why we want to actually pull the style sheets in first, and then we can actually use the style sheets to help render the screen, and subsequently we put our JavaScripts at the bottom, and we can call those as well. So in the scenario that we've got the code at the bottom, which is a little bit blurry, but in the scenario where we've got at the bottom, essentially what we've done based on the timeline at the top there is essentially we've moved all our style sheets across into the first column, as well as one of our JavaScript across into the first column. And then the second JavaScript file is moved across into the second column. So effectively, we've saved 100 milliseconds. Yeah, it's not much, but 100 milliseconds a page over X number of pages. It all adds up at the end of the day. So it's just simple things like this that are able to reduce time. CSS sprites, they're relatively commonly used, but I know lots of people that don't use them. Essentially, CSS sprites are, you just take all of a whole heap of commonly used images. You could use them for menu items or for icons that are going to be used on a page, and you just mash them all into a single image. And using CSS, you can actually specify a region on that image file, and you can actually pull that slice or that chunk of that image from that single image file and actually have that rendered on screen. So once again, we're not making multiple requests for a number of different icons or a number of different graphics that we're going to be displaying on screen. We only have to download one single graphic, and obviously we want to try and tidy up as much white space as possible. We don't want extraneous white space on this image. So essentially we're just getting a single image which has a number of images that we're able to pull our separate sprites from. Try to avoid using CSS at import where you can. CSS at import is essentially used to daisy chain CSS files. So essentially if you have a reference or call out to another CSS file from within one file, what has to happen is that the browser has to actually pass the first CSS file before it actually realizes, oh, there's another CSS file that I need to go and grab. So this causes a delay. It causes additional delay in browser rendering. It also causes an additional round trip, which we're trying to reduce in this section. That's not positive. I'm Apologies for that, guys. It's not often you get a Mac crash, but they do happen. So yeah, essentially, as I said, all of the things that I've been talking about today are standard common practices. And you know, obviously there's additional business benefits. Later on in the slide, I'm actually going to be talking about a case study with an organisation that puts considerable amount of traffic through. They have over 100 million hits a day. And when we're talking about that kind of traffic, you might think that 100 milliseconds here and 100 milliseconds there doesn't really add up. It does make a significant difference at the end of the day. So just still rebooting. Yep. So yeah, so in terms of all of the groups of the objects, or in terms of all of the groups of the stuff that I'm talking about today, caching definitely has a lot to do with offload. There's added benefits associated with caching. Compression, and we'll talk a little bit about compression as well. But the round trip times definitely are considerable. As I said, when you think about the fact that you can have up to 44 different objects on any given page, you'll potentially be causing delays at every level. So yeah, in terms of the fundamentals or the guidelines, a lot of it's just really basic, you know, common sense that you would probably, for those of you that actually went to uni, that you would have encountered in your studies. You know, there's just really fundamental, elementary stuff. A lot of the time when we work at organisations, they have, you know, they have processes and methodologies, and a lot of the time these common sense practices just sort of unfortunately fall by the wayside. And this unfortunately, you know, compounds itself over time. So this is why it's not necessarily always it's always easy to be able to implement these best practices, but I think that fundamentally, if you can go in and use perhaps presentations like this, or if you can use examples like Google and Yahoo have got, and they've got a lot of case studies as well, and as I said, companies like Aptimize, Blaze, Strange Loop, and these are companies that are going out and actually making money off, you know, I'm not going to call them sloppy coding practices, but as I said, they're fundamental foundation practices which everyone should be familiar with. Now, this is slowly loading. Sure, what's going on here? Apologies for this, guys. And that's exactly how I feel. So where were we? We were up to just past Sprite. So yeah, as I said, we want to try and avoid daisy chaining requests as CSS requests. So if you can actually, rather than using the at import in your style sheets, just use links, link relative, and just order your style sheets in the order that we've got listed there. And where possible, try and leverage async resources. So essentially leveraging async resources is going to, we talked about the problem before where when JavaScript's being executed in the browser, basically everything else stops until that JavaScript has been passed. And then once it's been passed, then you know, everything continues on. So if you do need to load JavaScript, what you can do is you can actually defer parsing of JavaScript by using a script DOM element. Essentially what we're doing there is we're just making an async call out to go and grab that JavaScript file, but we're delaying the actual parsing of that JavaScript file. So we'll go out and grab that JavaScript and We'll wait until all the other elements on the page have actually rendered, and then we'll actually be able to pass it then. Let's talk about minimizing request overheads. I guess one of the easiest in a lot of regards is to use a CDN, a content distribution network. Companies such as Akamai, my company that I work for, essentially they are, as I said before, how a CDN works, they have a global distributed network of servers. We have over 84,000 servers that are located around the globe. And essentially what we're able to do with those servers is that we're able to firstly cache content as close to the end user as possible. So the end user doesn't necessarily always need to come back to origin, to the web server, to actually get the content. Typically, it's very similar in a lot of regards to a proxy cache, but essentially we also have, I guess we call it our secret sauce, but essentially it's an intelligent mapping software which allows us to actually map end users to the optimal end user. So most people think, oh, the closest server to me or the closest is going to be my ISP, or it's going to be perhaps one hop up the network. But there's obviously a lot of issues or a lot of problems that can occur during the content being transmitted across the wire. It could be infrastructure breakdowns. It could be, unfortunately, there's monetary or business rules which basically dictate how traffic is passed across a network. So there's a number of factors that are actually controlling how traffic is passed across a network. So CDNs definitely, at a number of levels, they work on an IP, a TCP, and also an HTTP level. They increase performance, scalability, and availability of your content, and certainly worth leveraging them. As I mentioned before, all of the Microsofts, the Apples, Adobes, they all leverage a CDN service, and they can give considerable performance increases. You know, I've seen examples of up to 500% increases by leveraging CDN. So, especially for static content, they're very good for that as well. We want to look at minimizing request sizes. How do we do that? Well, typical packet size that we work with is 1,500 bytes. This is the default size that a network packet should be. One of the ways that we can actually look at reducing these packet sizes is to keep our cookies as small as possible. Where possible, try and use server-side cookies for storage and for payloads. And if you're going to be, if you're not going to be using fields or content that are contained within cookies, shrink them down, remove the fields, extraneous fields. Don't just load them up with variables and fields that you're not going to be using, because once again, this increases packet size and we want to reduce that overhead. And whilst we're talking about cookies, where possible, try and serve static content from cookieless domains. So essentially, this is really good for hot content that's viewed on a very regular basis, and static. So things like images, JavaScript and CSS, that changes perhaps not very often at all, but it's requested on a very regular or hot basis. And essentially what this involves is setting up a separate domain to serve static content from, it's a separate cookieless domain. And also in association with that, you can also, if you enable proxy caching with that, this also helps speed things up as well. I've got down the bottom there, don't serve early loaded JavaScript from a cookieless domain. Once again, coming back to the point that I made about JavaScript taking or causing a browser to actually stall whilst it's actually parsing and rendering JavaScript content, this potentially causes issues as well. Let's look at minimizing payload sizes. So there's a couple of common practices here. Use gzip compression where you can. Most browsers support compression, so you'd be mad not to actually use it, and this is a really easy one to use. Essentially, all you need to do is just configure your content encoding on your web server and make sure that you can set up content encoding to be used. Obviously, with compression or gzip files, that works best on text-based files. And also, where possible, if you can minify your JavaScript and CSS before you actually compress them, you get added bonus as well. I've seen even minified code be considerably reduced in size when you actually use gzip. And gzip's just basically for the duration of the journey across the network. So basically, it's compressed at the web server, transmitted across the wire, compressed. When it hits the browser, it just decompresses in the web server. So you're actually saving considerable amount of payload size there. Images and binary files are already compressed, so you don't want to go and use compression on these guys. If you try, you're not really going to make a lot of savings by way of file size. In some instances, you're actually going to add to the file size, so just keep that in mind when you're working with compression. Removing unused scripts, it's a bit of a no-brainer, but a lot of the time, as developers, we all know that we might just put some patch code or just some sandbox code in a script just for whilst we're working and developing, and may or may not end up using that code. Try to go through and reduce the unused code that you're going to be using, and this obviously is going to increase parsing performance as well. And it also reduces the footprint size that you're going to be working with by way of traffic that's going across the wire. It is common in large teams. You tend to see it more in large development teams where you get a number of guys working on perhaps the same bit of code, but then it gets merged at one point. There's going to be functions and classes and instances of code that's not going to be leveraged that may have been useful at one point but just hasn't been optimized out of the equation. So it's worth keeping in mind. I talked a bit more before about minifying your JavaScript and CSS. You can use products such as JSMin, CSSMin, or the UE Compressor. And these are great products. They're free. And essentially, as I said, it just strips out the white space and page breaks and any extraneous characters that aren't going to be used in your scripts. And it speeds up parsing and execution of your code. Defer your JavaScript loading. We talked before about placing the JavaScripts after the CSS. This is going to defer the parsing of the JavaScript, but also the calling and the loading of the JavaScript. So what you can also do is you can set up a small amount of inline JavaScript, which is basically a listener, which is going to listen for an onload event for when the page is actually finished browsing, finished rendering, or loading, I should say. And once the page is actually finished loading, then you can go and grab your JavaScript. So it's basically a way to delay the calling or the loading of your JavaScript into your code. Once again, the end user is being presented with a web page that's loading and rendering quickly. They're at least getting a good user experience. They're not being presented with a blank web page. Optimize images. It's a bit of a no-brainer. A lot of people, though, don't necessarily come from a graphic design background or even a web graphic design background, so they don't necessarily know which format they should be using. PNGs and JPEGs obviously are better for higher quality images, whereas GIFs are for lower quality images. Play around with image compression. You can do some amazing stuff in products like Photoshop and Fireworks to actually tweak image compression. Just crop out unnecessary space that you don't need to use. And where possible, use a web palette. They used to be the rage, and they seem to have died out in later years, but just purely because there's more bandwidth to push pixels around or to push content around. But the reality is that if you can use a web color palette, you are going to be saving file size when you're going to be passing graphics around. And inline images, this is a bit of a funky one. I've seen it used a couple of times, and it's an interesting one. Basically, you Base64 encode your graphics, and you can actually include those graphics in your code using the data URL scheme, and that graphic is actually going to be rendered on screen. So once again, it's a reduced call. You don't need to make an additional call. There are some caveats with it, so IE doesn't really like it. Anything under IE8 doesn't really handle it really well, and you're restricted to a maximum image size of 100K. I'm just going to quickly talk about browser rendering and how we can actually improve the performance of content to be rendered in the browser. So essentially, you want to avoid CSS expressions. If the browser has to actually go and compile and parse CSS expressions, this obviously degrades browser and rendering performance. Try to use standard CSS properties to obviously help alleviate that, and use JavaScript to help improve script styles rather than going with CSS expression if you need to use one. I talked a bit before about placing CSS and JavaScript files in the head. It's actually part of the spec, so it's good to listen to what the spec says because it's there for a reason. So try to always use place your CSS calls in the document head and not in the body, and don't use add import if you're going to be calling your CSS from external. Specify your image dimensions. Don't just scale images in HTML code. A lot of people actually will take a 500 by 500 pixel image and resize that to 250 by 250 in the actual code. This is a pretty common practice, but it causes unnecessary cycles in the browser because it has to actually reflow and repaint the region. It knows that the file that it's got is larger than the one that's expected to display. So subsequently, this causes unnecessary cycles. Make sure that you correctly set the image dimensions. And the last one just relates to character encoding. Specify a content type. And make sure you don't use a meta-quiv tag if you're going to be specifying content character encoding, primarily because in IE8, if you're going to be using a meta-quiv tag, IE8 has what's called a look-ahead downloader, and I believe it causes some issues with that. That was one of the ones that sort of popped up on the radar, just to be watchful when you're actually specifying your character encoding. So does this stuff work? I guess it must work if Google and Yahoo are actually going to be proclaiming it and talking about it. Here's an example of a company that I mentioned before, ShopZilla. They have 20 to 29 million unique visitors per month and 100 million page impressions a day. They've got over 100,000 products on their catalog, and by implementing the best practices that have been outlined here, they increased their availability from 99.65 to 99.97. Doesn't sound like much, but when you're dealing with 100 million page impressions a day, that's a lot. Page load times came down a staggering, 4.8 seconds, which is phenomenal. And you can imagine from a user experience perspective what impact that actually would have. Increased page views, obviously, because they're able to turn over more pages more quickly by 25%. Bottom line, though, is that they increased revenue by 12%. So this is a real-world example of how this stuff is actually making a big difference, how performance is actually making a difference. If all of this just sounds like too hard work and you can't be bothered doing any of this, as I mentioned before, there's companies out there that will gladly take your money off you and do it for you. They have a great system set up, and as I mentioned before, this startup Aptimize came out of New Zealand, and they're a great success story out of New Zealand, and they're doing really well in Silicon Valley at the moment. Essentially, what they've done is they've taken these best practices and these guidelines, and they've put them in Kit, and they're basically going through your code, and they're applying these rules and these guidelines to your code. There's certainly a need for them, there's certainly a requirement for them, because a lot of businesses, as I said before, especially if you're a large dev house, you have processes in place, and changing work dev processes can be a time-consuming task, and sometimes it's just easier to get someone else to actually do that for you. So these organisations are more than happy to do that for you if you're interested. So just the takeaways from today's session, optimise caching where possible. Reduce and minimize your round-trip times. Reduce your request overloads, so bring those down as much as you can. Minimize your payload size, try and get your files as small as possible, and optimize your browser rendering where possible. And that's it for today, guys. Thanks very much for coming along. We've got a small amount of time, so if anyone has any questions, feel free to yell them out. Otherwise, I think they're breaking on the terrace for lunch, so please enjoy.